Mr. Sala?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Your Honor, we're reserving 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, I have you down for that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, sir. May it please the court, James Sala for appellants. This case involves two main issues. First, whether a college student who bought and sold securities out of the condo he shared with his mother must register as a securities dealer. And second, whether disgorgement is the appropriate remedy for a registration violation that didn't harm anyone. The district court got both issues wrong. I want to begin by addressing the disgorgement error because that's the most significant material to my client, and then turn to the dealer error in light of two cases from this circuit.
Yeah, we'll want to talk about the Big Apple decision, but go ahead.
Sure. That's one of the cases, sir. Counsel for amici is going to deal primarily with the dealer error based on the statutory interpretation of the rule at issue.
Okay.
Notably, Your Honor, this is not a fraud case. This is not involved manipulation or any deceit. The sole claim is that Mr. Almugharbi failed to register as a securities dealer, and as a result of not registering, the district court ordered disgorgement, which is going to have basically financially destroy Mr. Almugharbi.
Didn't the commission explain that it planned to distribute the awards to counterparties who had purchased shares from your client and who lost money by the later devaluations caused by his selling activity?
Well, there's two problems with that, Your Honor. They haven't identified anybody. And the largest, they want $885,000 in disgorgement, 507 of which is when Mr. Almugharbi sold one stock. And that was into a market that continued to go up. So the counterparties in that transaction actually made money. The stock continued to go up. And that's in the Lowry affidavit. That's the largest significant. And in other instances, Your Honor, and we lay this out in the Katz affidavit, which is in exhibit, I think, docket entry 125, there's massive dilution. These companies use cash, they use shares like currency. There's tons of issuances of stock during the same time Mr. Almugharbi sold.
I thought what the SEC said, though, was they were going to, it was going to be for county parties who lost money, and there was an expert who testified that it was, that you could identify those counterparties using the electronic blue sheet system, right?
Right. But one of those counterparties were the counterparties who bought $507,000 worth of, he sold, of the $885,000, 507 of which, net-net, he sold at a profit. That's the bulk of that. He sold that into a rising market. The stock is identified in the Lowry affidavit. They just never backed that out because they didn't focus on the disgorgement. They only focused on his profits. And because they hadn't identified the counterparties and what happened to the stock afterwards, that was the sole measure of damages. That was the sole finding in the court's order. And that order, by the way, that dovetails directly into the issues that I have on disgorgement. First of all, the order didn't comport with Liu. Liu, as you know, Your Honor, radically changed how courts mistreat disgorgement. Prior to Liu, the purpose was to deprive people of ill-gotten gains, and that's how the court's order viewed disgorgement here. Liu determined that for disgorgement to be truly equitable, it has to be paid to victims. And just saying, hey, there's a class of victims, and the stock went down, he sold into the market, that doesn't do it. They only measured his ill-gotten gains. They never measured what happened afterwards. In a lot of these cases, Your Honor, there are no victims. Moreover, Your Honor, they have a causal problem. In this court, in both Sedati and Southern Metals, have said there's got to be a causal connection between the sale and the violation and the fraud. In fact, in the new statute that was amended, 21D, it says specifically that unjust enrichment, disgorgement for unjust enrichment, has to result from the violation. Whether Mr. Almugharbi was registered as a dealer or whether he was not has no bearing on whether stocks went up or down, whether he sold at a profit or he sold at a loss. He could have engaged in the same conduct the same exact conduct, made the same profits, whether he was registered as a dealer or not.
He was prohibited, though, if he was prohibited from making transactions as an unregistered dealer, right? Any profits generated from prohibited transactions were causally linked to his wrongdoing, weren't they?
No. That puts the cart before the horse. That correlates the violation, as Southern Metal says, correlates but doesn't cause. Just because he's unregistered, they use the example of an unregistered lawyer. The lawyer may screw up because he's unregistered, right, or because he's not licensed as a lawyer, but that doesn't cause the violation or the problem for the client. What causes, what results from that that unlicensed doesn't necessarily cause it. It just the correlation doesn't necessarily cause or the violate the unregistered, his status as a dealer. He could have done the same stuff if he was a dealer. He could have engaged in the same transactions, all of which were legal. The only thing that the SEC cites is in the Lowry affidavit, which is based on a rule that deals with public offerings. And it says an underwriter, if he's an underwriter, which is now what the SEC seems to pivot to, and he's not because 144 exempts him from that. He sold every one of these, and they've conceded, and the court found he sold pursuant to 144. So unlike Big Apple, he's not an underwriter. He availed himself to 144.
He's certainly engaged in activity that looks a lot like underwriting.
Sir, but he's exempt because he complied with 144. And under 144, if you comply with that, he got a legal opinion in each instance, you can't be an underwriter. It exempts from, and he was not involved in a distribution. And the court found, and the SEC has conceded, they haven't disputed those findings of facts, that in every sale he complied with 144.
He obtained convertible debentures directly from the issuers, right? And then sent...
No, sir.
Directly sent the conversion notices triggering the creation of the new shares.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, he did that.
He didn't purchase from an underwriter. He converted debt, perfectly legal. And when he did so, when he sold pursuant to Rule 144. And Rule 144...
By exercising his conversion options, he, in effect, obtained new shares from the issuers, which he then distributed.
He didn't distribute them. 144, again, it's a rule that was not in place, by the way, with Eastside Church. And Big Apple, by the way, found that they did not comply. They violated Rule 144.
Well, Mr. Sala, the time's got you. We've got... If you want to save those 2 minutes...
Yes, sir.
And give your friend some time. We need to hear from
him. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Gillette.
May it please the court. Gabriel Gillette from Jenner & Block on behalf of the industry Amici. The district court read the Exchange Act's dealer definition to sweep in every single mutual fund, pension fund, hedge fund, and institutional investor when it found that trading securities as a business is conclusive proof of dealer status.
Can't we decide this case far more narrowly than that? Can't we decide this case on these facts that this individual was a dealer under the Exchange Act?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the activity that Mr. Almugarby engaged in looks an awful lot like the buying and selling of securities as a business that happens every day by the most sophisticated
firms. So he acquires microcap shares at a steep discount, immediately resells them for profit. He says his goal was to turn his money around as fast as possible. He sold his holdings within days or weeks. He explained that his business model made money by buying the stock at a discount, selling it at market, and the difference was the profit. He did little to no research, had no long-term views on the values of his holdings, was not interested in taking on price risk. He instead relied on high volumes of trade execution to make profits. He brings new shares to the market. This is what he does. This is his business. This is all he's doing.
Your Honor,
we could say that is dealer activity. Could we not? Without a broad ruling that concerns your clients.
I certainly like the idea of a narrow ruling, Your Honor, but I do want to press you a little bit that there's a fundamental difference between the business of investing and the business of dealing. And so what you've described, someone who gets shares on the one hand, holds them for whatever amount of time they think makes sense under their investment thesis, and then sells them at a profit, that's investing. The business of dealing is a different thing. The business of dealing is intermediating transactions for other people. That's why the definition of dealer talks about transacting in one's own account, as distinct from the definition of broker, which talks about transacting in someone else's account. That's what everybody understood in 1934. That's what companies continue to understand today.
Didn't he really create new securities and was responsible for the proliferation of the issuer shares in the marketplace?
He received new shares from the issuer and he sold them. But that, I think, is fundamentally different from what a dealer does. A dealer works both sides of the markets. A dealer quotes buy prices and sell prices. A dealer brings together transactions between sellers on one side and buyers on the other. What he has described, what happened here, getting shares and selling them at a profit, describes what everybody does all the time. And no one...
Dealers normally participate in the sale or distribution of new issues, right?
That's right, but that characteristic doesn't make someone a dealer. Yeah. What makes someone a dealer is intermediating the transaction. And I think the court should go back to 1934, which is when the statute was enacted. That's when we look to what Congress intended. At that time, there is no evidence that Congress intended for dealer to capture every investor. If you fast forward 6 years to 1940, Congress passes the Investment Company Act and defines an investment company as someone engaged in the business of investing and trading securities. Now, that makes no sense in context if in 1934, Congress intended in the dealer definition to capture everyone who is buying and selling securities as a business and profiting. And if you fast forward even past 1940, go to 1990, Congress passes the Large Trader Reporting Rule. It's Section 78M, subsection H. What Congress says is if you're a large trader, meaning you trade 2 million shares or shares worth $20 million a day, you need to identify yourself to your broker-dealer. Your broker-dealer needs to save your records and be subject to examination. But no one in 1990 thought that large traders were broker-dealers, and the SEC has never said that since. Go back to the Burton case in 1977, where an investment fund comes to the SEC and says, "We want to have an investment club. It looks like we need to register as a dealer, right?" The SEC says, "No, you don't." The difference, the line is between investors on the one side and dealers on the other. And what dealers do is hold themselves out to both sides of the market. A dealer quotes buy and sell prices. A dealer profits on the spread in between, not on price appreciation or market fluctuation or other sorts of risks.
Excuse me, Counselor, given your time is diminishing, I just want to be clear on what are the market implications of affirming the district court's ruling. Mr. Sala stated very clearly, emphatically almost, that the behavior that his client engaged in did not have a victim, that the behavior he engaged in he could have done as he was operating as himself or as a registered dealer. So what really are the major implications, sky is falling argument that you're raising in your brief?
Sure, Your Honor. So first, if you agree with Mr. Sala, as I do, that disgorgement was improper here, then I think that's great because the industry is not then at risk of disgorging billions of dollars of profits. If you disagree and you find disgorgement is valid, then I think that's market harm number one. Every investment company, every mutual fund and pension fund that's trading on behalf of their investors is now subject to billions in disgorgement.
Well, but you talked earlier about the Congress's, I guess, purpose behind the 1934 Act, and one of those purposes is to impose requirements necessary to regulate and control the reporting and execution of transactions and to protect interstate commerce. So isn't that exactly what is at issue here?
I don't think so, Your Honor. No one disputes that the SEC has that mission. But if I can encourage the court to read one decision, go read the Goldstein case. It's a challenge to the SEC's 2004 hedge fund rule. The SEC says in 2004, hedge funds are big, hedge funds are trading a lot, hedge funds are engaging in convertible arbitrage, which looks a lot like what's happening here, so we want to regulate it. And what they did was took the term client in the Investment Advisors Act from 1940 and came up with a new interpretation of that old statutory language. The D.C. Circuit said no. The D.C. Circuit said the SEC can't manipulate the meaning of a statute in order to expand its own regulatory power.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Shillette. We're going to hear from Mr. Frieda now.
May it please the court, Dominic Frieda, on behalf of the Securities and Exchange Commission. You know, a dealer is defined as one engaged in the business of buying and selling securities for such person's own account,
right,
through
a
broker or otherwise.
So we have that, but let me ask you this. As a practical matter, and just to help me understand what the stakes are here, let's say that Mr. Almugarby had been registered as a dealer. What options would have been open to the SEC to regulate him and his activities that were not because they didn't know he was allegedly a dealer?
Sure. As this court said in Eastside Church, the dealer registration provision is of the utmost importance in regulating the markets.
Right, and, but I'm asking, in this case, what difference would it make?
Well, let me just go through what registration would entail, okay? First, Meg would have had to register as a broker-dealer, which means filing a form, joining FINRA, setting up appropriate personnel, a compliance officer, establishing policies and procedures, bookkeeping systems, accounting controls. Almugarby would have had to been an associated person because he was the principal of the firm. All associated persons have to acquire appropriate licenses, like a Series 7 license. They have to undergo a background check. They have statutory disqualifications which would apply. And they would be subject to appropriate supervision by both the commission and FINRA.
Well, let me maybe make this, I want to ask it on a sort of grander level.
Sure.
In this case, what options would have been available to the SEC to regulate the activity that Mr. Almugarby was engaging in if he had complied with all of those requirements? I'm not trying to suggest that that's not important. I'm just trying to figure out the practical implications here.
Sure. I mean, one of the things, he would have been subject to books and records exams, both by the commission and by FINRA.
Okay, I'm sorry. Maybe I'm just not explaining my question well. Let me try again. So would the SEC have had the ability to, let's assume he had complied with all the dealer requirements, he was licensed, et cetera, and he's still engaged in this activity. What options would have been open to the SEC to stop him or to curb his activity or anything of that nature?
Well, I mean, if what you're getting at is whether his activity was illegal in terms of the convertible note business that he was running, other than the registration violation for not registering as a dealer, no, he could have engaged in that. I would point out I am unaware of any registered broker-dealers who engage in this type of convertible debt dealings because, as we pointed out on our brief, it's pretty disfavored within the industry, and it's really something that is targeted towards penny stock issuers and micro-cap companies.
But there's nothing illegal about it.
No.
And there's nothing that violates any kinds of SEC regulations. So in other words, one of the things that's talked about in here is about how it resulted in death spirals, right, of some of these companies. And so you wouldn't have been in a position to stop these death spirals from occurring.
That's correct.
Thank you.
I would point out, you know, one of the things that could happen as a result of having people like Mr. Almugarby and Meg register is that through the books and records and through the examinations, FINRA and the commission could, if they found that this is a widespread phenomenon, could do something in addition to, you know, to go at the activity itself. Commission hasn't, FINRA hasn't to date, but it is an option. This is an evolving area.
I see. So let me ask you something, I mean, not exactly related to that, but that sort of draws on the idea that the SEC reacts to things as they develop in the market. And I noticed that in 2022, you issued a notice of proposed rulemaking that would bring in people like Mr. Almugarby, I guess without question, under the folds of a dealer. And I wonder whether the fact that you thought it was necessary to issue such a notice of proposed rulemaking may indicate anything about whether or not the public was on notice that someone in Mr. Almugarby's position would qualify as a dealer before you issued the notice.
Sure. I mean, if respectfully, the proposed rule really has nothing to do with the activity that Mr. Almugarby was engaged in. The proposed rule is targeted at...
Right, whether he had to register as a dealer, right? Whether he's a dealer.
I'm misunderstanding then, but if you, with your indulgence, the proposed rule goes after what is essentially market making, mostly within the government securities area, in which the amici have commented on that rulemaking. It's still in proposal. It's still under consideration. Regarding the lack of customers for some of these high-frequency trading firms that have engaged in liquidity provision.
But you're saying that's not what Almugarby was doing?
No, not at all. What he was doing was underwriting activity. He was soliciting issuers in order to distribute new issues of securities on the market for an immediate profit.
Did you previously describe him as having participated in underwriting activity?
I believe so. I mean, I haven't gone back to scrub the record, but I believe so. But also the activity itself, whether you call it underwriting activity or not, is exactly the same. It's what this court pointed to in Big Apple and Eastside Church. It's the, you know, bringing a new issue of securities to market. It's a term of art in, you know, the securities area that it's
and
underwriting
the record
activity.
Established that he was doing that. That
yes.
He was.
Yes. The activity was clearly established. And that activity, by the way, going back to Eastside Church, an interesting fact, one of the arguments Amiki is making is that we're expanding the definition of a dealer. But I would just read from a amicus brief that the commission submitted to this court in 1968 and said that in determining whether the defendant there falls within the definition, the question involved is essentially that of distinguishing between a person who buys and sells securities as part of a business and an ordinary trader or investor who buys and sells securities with some frequency, but not as part of a business. That's exactly the standard that we have been applying since before and since that case. And that's exactly the standard this court adopted in Big Apple. So there's nothing new here. And all we ask the court, as Judge Pryor was saying, is issue an opinion that says, consistent with our court's precedents and the statutory language, we find that the defendants were dealers and they did not register as required.
So you're saying that amici shouldn't be concerned about the decision in this case and instead should focus their attention on the rules that are being proposed?
You know, yes, Your Honor, yes, I do. As I said, they've submitted exactly the same argument. They've submitted that argument before. The commission rejected it in a rulemaking regarding a swap dealer and said that a customer requirement doesn't really make sense under the regulatory regime. And I can go into great detail about why that is. But
I think I also, and I don't know if this was Judge Rosenbaum's question, but my question is, assuming that Mr. Almugarby isn't a dealer, then beyond having to pay taxes, what other requirements would he have been or is subject to?
Well, in terms of, you know, being as a registered dealer?
The argument is that he's not, right? So what other regulations would he therefore have to abide by? Because, again, he feels that he's doing behavior that doesn't qualify as a dealer, but still has some, and I'm asking, some government oversight?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the things I was pointing out before, you know, in order to be registered, you have to meet certain qualifications. You know, and as for an individual, he would have to be licensed. You know, so he'd have to sit for those exams. You know, that experience requirement and that, you know, qualification is, you know, crucially important. In addition, you know, he's subject to the oversight of FINRA and the commission, you know, so he'd have to keep appropriate books and records. He'd have to have appropriate personnel. He'd have to have compliance officer, somebody.
You want to talk about disgorgement before you sit down?
Yes, absolutely. as to disgorgement, you know, this court's precedents control. The decision in the Second Circuit in Govel is not binding here. We think the decision is wrong, it would be a departure from this court's precedents in Blatt and Calvo and Hard Candy, as we pointed out in our 28J letter. Disgorgement is based on profits and the idea from equity that you were not entitled to profit from your own wrongdoing. So the notion that you need to show that a victim suffered pecuniary harm really isn't part of what equity would require, because it's focusing on the wrong party. So that's the reason why Govel is wrong, and it conflicts with this court's precedent.
Yeah, can't exceed the wrongdoer's net profits, and then that is equitable relief available to victims, right?
Yes, absolutely. As Lou was outlining, you know, one of the things in equity is that you would assume that you would try to make whole those people who are harmed. And so in the instances in which you can have identifiable victims, the commission should try to distribute the proceeds it collects back to those victims. And that's what we vowed to do here. We indicated before the district court that we have identified victims, and we will be able to distribute to them, assuming we can collect anything on the disgorgement award.
How much have you identified in victims? How much have you identified as victims have lost?
You mean in terms of numbers of people?
In terms of dollars.
Oh, dollar? Oh, gosh. I don't know the answer to that. I'd have to go back to the record, but I believe it's in the record. And as I said, I mean, it's not a hard thing to do given, you know, the current state of how transactions work. You know, if we were in the over-the-counter market back in 1968, it probably would have been hard to run down everyone. But in these days, we have the records in order to do it. But I don't know the actual number of the amount of money. I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay. it is a little, of course, there's the concept of, he should have registered, assuming you're right, he should have registered as a dealer. He would have had to have undergone all of this extra training and these examinations and have these records and books, and there would have been costs entailed in all of that that would have eaten away at any profits that he otherwise would have made. And so it seems like that would be attributable to, or maybe you could make an argument that there's cause an effect there, or causally related. But it just seems like a kind of strange argument when you say that he wasn't doing anything that was illegal, and he could have done it if he had been registered as a dealer, to just assume all of it is therefore ill-gotten gains. I mean, maybe it is. I just wonder, I want to give you an opportunity to speak to that a little bit.
Sure. I mean, it really comes from how the statute is written. Section 15 prohibits the transactions being made in interstate commerce themselves. when you were unregistered as a dealer. And so if you assume, what is the violation then? It's engaging in the transactions themselves.
As an unregistered dealer.
As an unregistered dealer. And so logically speaking, you know, once you take away the profit of that legal transaction. So the transactions are illegal, and if I gave you the impression that they weren't earlier, they are. It's just for a different reason. And they didn't have to be registered under the Securities Act, which is another way.
They might not be illegal if a registered dealer did them.
Exactly. So that's the distinction.
Thank you.
Okay.
And it's possible that he could have engaged in that behavior at a loss, and so he could have still been found to have failed to register, but not any pecuniary damages levied against him.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's I couldn't add anything to that. If you have any further questions, we ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Frieda. Mr. Sala, you've saved 2 minutes.
Briefly, Your Honor, the statute must be read in context. When the decision below, the SEC's theory cannot survive without contradicting at least 90 years and at least sweeping every mutual fund, pension fund, institutional investor, and Mr. Almugarby.
Why does it sweep in every mutual fund, pension fund, et cetera, if we were to rule in the way that the chief has suggested?
Why wouldn't it?
Why would it? Why would it sweep in every mutual fund, pension fund, et cetera?
Because now you're including individuals who aren't market intermediaries. They're not making markets. They're not underwriting.
But there's more. But there would be more to it than that, right? It's not just that you're including.
Day traders would be included. Think about somebody who buys and sells with high frequency traders. Anybody who trades for their own account for a profit in volume would be included.
Well, except that if you include the whole activity that I know you disagree is underwriting, but let's say that it looks like underwriting. If you include that activity in the description, then doesn't that take out a bunch of these other entities that you're talking about? Or maybe it doesn't.
Well,
trying to find out.
Underwriting is included in dealer activity at times. Some underwriters are exempt, but for example, Big Apple, which was decided under a different statute, it does not have a trader exception like the 34 Act does. The case issue. But in that case, underwriters are included. Big Apple was found to have violated.
Right. But I guess maybe I didn't ask the question well. Let me try again. My question is, if you included underwriting or that type of activity as one of the, which is included as one of the factors, and you specified it in this case, and we found that his activity fell into that bucket, and I'm not saying we necessarily would, but just for purposes of the hypothetical, doesn't that then give you a way to distinguish this case from mutual funds, pension funds, et cetera? Or maybe it doesn't. That's what I'm trying to find out.
If you included underwriting in the statute itself, under the 15A?
It is one of the factors.
It is.
Right.
The SEC's identified underwriting. But underwriters understand underwriters intermediate between an issuer, right? They have clients. Like Big Apple, this court found that Big Apple had clients. The client was the issuer, right, which Almugarby didn't. They then match up. They then create a market for the stock. They go out and get indications of interest. They decide how to price it. Underwriting activity is very, very involved. Not all underwriters are dealers, though. You can see that in the Aqua Wellington no action letter, because all they did was underwriting. But again,
mutual funds, pensions, et cetera, do they underwrite?
No, not necessarily, but they intermediate sometimes between buyers, and they buy and sell, right, frequently their own account. And again, 144, unlike Big Apple, they violated, they didn't comply with 144. Mr. Almugarby complied with it, so he was deemed not to be an underwriter and not to be involved.
Okay, Mr. Sala.
Sorry, sir. Thank you.
We understand your argument. Your case is under submission. Tokyo Gwinnett LLC versus Gwinnett County.